Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the weekend podcast. I'd love to see this. I'm here with Josh. And
hello.
We're going to be picking up where we left off yesterday, talking about Marx and debunking Marx's view on the individual and human motivation and selfishness, things like that.
Exactly. So I want to kick us off with a quote from Marx talking about human motivation. So he's got a bit of a weird choice of words here, so I will explain it once I've gone through it. But man is directly a natural being. As a natural being and as a living natural being, he is on the one hand endowed with natural powers, vital powers. He is an active natural being. These forces exist in him as tendencies and abilities, as instincts. On the other hand, as a natural, corporeal, sensuous object, objective being even, he is suffering, conditioned, and a limited creature, like animals and plants. That is to say, the objects of his instincts exist outside of him as objects independent of him, yet these objects are objects that he needs, essential objects, indispensable to the manifestation and the confirmation of his essential powers.
Okay.
So essentially, he's saying that human instincts provide us with needs, and those needs are outside of ourselves, and therefore we have to do things to fulfill those needs, which is really not very controversial to pretty much anyone, I should imagine.
It's a very drawn-out way of saying that.
Yeah. I mean, he could have framed it a little bit more concisely, but this isn't like a review of Marx's writing style, unfortunately, which is very dense and pretty annoying, actually. But he also says, in simpler terms, it is true that eating, drinking, and procreating, etc., are genuine human functions. However, when abstracted from the aspects of human activity and turned into final and exclusive ends, they are animal.
Okay.
So this ties into his view that capitalism is the product of perhaps selfish desires as well, because he's essentially saying human beings obviously have these needs, or they have an instinct to fulfill needs of eating, drinking, and procreating, but anything that is kind of outside of this realm is what we would perhaps consider being a human being. Just simply fulfilling needs is what animals do, and that's what he's arguing. He's arguing for something above this essentially base drive.
So does he say that these base things are what makes us human and what we have in common with animals? Or is it that there's something else that makes
us
human?
He's saying it's something else. So he's saying these needs are kind of animalistic. They define us in what we have to do, but they do not define what being a human being is,
right,
necessarily.
Yep. Yeah.
And I don't necessarily disagree with that, actually. I think that's a perfectly reasonable position. However, it seems to tie into his view that capitalism somehow perverts human nature, essentially, that it makes people see these ends as, or these desires as ends in themselves, sorry.
Right. So he's saying that human nature is something beyond these base needs.
Yeah.
But because that's capitalism, mm-hmm. these things that go beyond are not actualized because capitalism forces everyone to act on these base needs instead of being properly human and actualizing yourself.
Yeah. So the actual language he uses is that capitalism fetishizes these needs, essentially. Like, mm-hmm. they make them seem like they're an end in themselves rather than fulfilling some kind of higher purpose.
So the point then is that capitalism mm-hmm. makes you less human and makes you more like an animal because you follow these animal instincts. You're prevented, basically, by society, by the economic system, from developing your true nature.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's what he believes.
Okay.
However, I would say that capitalism's focus on these needs at the time that Marx was writing was not unfounded. Like, they weren't at a point where food and clean water were kind of abundant.
Right.
At the time of Marx writing. And in fact, many of Marx's own children were malnourished. So he should have been well aware of this. One of his children died mainly due to faults of his own. He was not short of money. He just spent it on himself, which, is a whole other can of worms, but he's not exactly the most moral person, as you can probably imagine by the manifestation of his ideas. But anyway, I'd like to move on to why I don't think this idea is correct with a bit of science. So okay. I'd like to kind of look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which I don't necessarily agree with this model per se, and I'll get onto that in a second, but it's good for kind of making the point that you have these base needs and you have the need for food, water, warmth, rest, and then you have higher needs like security, safety, all the way up to things like self-actualization, which is like pursuing your goals and having psychological fulfillment. Although this self-actualization is what is perhaps disputed. Oh, siren getting past. So there's certainly a cultural component to this, which I'll get onto, because a lot of criticism of Maslow's hierarchy of needs is that it's very culturally specific to the West.
Right. And so just to make clear, the idea is that you have some needs that are more basic, are kind of more base, and that you have to satisfy in order to be able to essentially care about the others. And so the more mm-hmm. needs you satisfy, the further and further you get
up the pyramid. Yeah,
exactly. And so that you don't like get to think mm-hmm. about or kind of consider the higher needs when you haven't satisfied the lower ones. So that's the basic idea, if I understand mm-hmm. it correctly.
Yeah. Right. Yep. And that there have been plenty of criticisms to suggest that it's not actually a pyramid and there's lots of exchange between certain layers. And essentially the theory is discredited, but it's something that everyone is familiar with and it kind of gets the gist of the point across. So we can kind of see...
And so is it discredited as a whole, or is it just discredited as this kind of this specific thing, specifically with those things that are mentioned in the original pyramid?
Yeah.
Something like that. Not that the idea that some needs are less important or kind of less basic and some more basic.
The underlying philosophy behind it hasn't been discredited.
Okay.
But the actual objective structuring of the pyramid.
Right, so the specific content of the tiers, right?
Yeah, so it's just more of a theoretical point than a philosophical one.
Makes sense, yeah.
So I want to quickly go into a study of cultural influence on motivation to kind of prove the point that motivation is something that is perhaps more in the head than in your biology, almost as Marx says. So I'm kind of making his point for him here. But essentially, it's a study that is called Rethinking the Value of Choice, a Cultural Perspective on Intrinsic Motivation. And the study says that Anglo-American children showed less intrinsic motivation when choices were made for them by others than when they made their own choices, whether the others were authority figures or peers. In contrast, Asian American children proved most intrinsically motivated when the choices were made for them by trusted authority figures or peers. So it's kind of showing some degree of cultural influence on how people are motivated, which seems to suggest that...
And it's not innate to your biological nature.
So although Marx's characterization of human beings being motivated by something else in their nature might not necessarily be correct, there's certainly a need for motivation. So he's close to being correct, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So there's a theory of people's needs and motivation known as the free needs theory by McClelland, which generally speaking, research shows that 86% of the population is at least dominant in one or two or all three of these types of motivation, and they are need for achievement, need for affiliation, and need for power, which sounds very sinister, but it's not actually as bad as it sounds. So need for achievement is where people who have a need for achievement prefer to work on tasks of moderate difficulty in which results are based on their efforts rather than on anything else to receive feedback on their work. Achievement-based individuals tend to avoid both high-risk and low-risk situations. Low-risk situations are seen as too easy to be valid, and high-risk situations are seen as based more on luck of the situation rather than the achievements that the individual actually made. So this personality type is motivated by accomplishment in places like the workplace, and they excel in employment where there is a hierarchy with kind of opportunity for promotion.
Okay.
And just to kind of backtrack a little bit, this theory kind of acknowledges the culturally different needs. So it can explain the differences in the previous study. Need for achievement is perhaps more of a Western notion, whereas this next one, the need for affiliation, might explain why the Asian American children were more keen to have their motivation set for them by someone else. And essentially,
it's worth pointing out probably that we're not attributing anything to any individual. We're saying that on average, this is what was showed in the studies.
It's like statistical trends and generalizations. Obviously, there are exceptions to every rule, yep. And I'm not trying to make any generalizations about people. I'm just trying to kind of recite what the research says.
It's an obligatory caveat.
So. Of course.
The need for affiliation then.
Okay, so people who have a need for affiliation prefer to spend time creating and maintaining social relationships and enjoy being part of groups and have a desire to feel loved and accepted. People in this group tend to adhere to the norms of the culture in the workplace and typically do not challenge the norms of the workplace for fear of rejection. This person favours collaboration over competition and does not like situations with high risk or high uncertainty. People who have the need for affiliation work well in areas based on social interaction like customer service or client interaction positions. So obviously you can see this is a little bit workplace focused, but I mean, it's good to kind of give you real world examples that you might have experience with, because otherwise it's too much in abstraction.
Yep.
Sometimes. Yep. So the need for power. People who have a need for power prefer to work and place a high value on discipline. The downside to this motivational type is that group goals can become zero sum in nature. That is, for one person to win, another must lose. However, this can be positively applied to help accomplish group goals and to help others in the group feel competent about their work. A person motivated by this need enjoys status recognition, winning arguments, competition, and influencing others. So it's basically YouTube comment sections. So you can see that there's a very different characterization here from kind of modern psychology than how Marx characterizes human motivation. He's very focused on very base needs, whereas this is all directed at kind of psychological needs.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's just a product of the different times in which these theories have come from. Obviously, this is a very modern theory and it caters to modern motivations to act, which are mainly psychological, whereas in Marx's time, there was a lot of focus on just satisfying your desire for food and
on
water.
Economic motivations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it seems to suggest that although perhaps Marx was right for his time, it's not as applicable in the modern day.
So if someone in the modern day had a desire for money or to have that kind of economic motivation, that could be kind of filed under one of these boxes as well. Just not necessarily, but in a way where money represents something else. Money represents a satisfaction of another psychological need rather than an end in itself.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly wouldn't discredit the notion that certain people might see money as an end in and of itself. I feel like I've come across a certain few people that feel that way. And certainly money is a sign of status where perhaps it shouldn't be. But I'm going into a tangent again. So you can essentially see that the Marx's theory of motivation has kind of gone out of date. And although it doesn't necessarily describe human beings today, it's not necessarily something that he was wrong about in his day.
So could we say that it describes something fairly accurately, but it's only a narrow part of people's motivation? Yeah. That they do have this economic motivation, and that is a driving factor with people, but it's not the only driving factor. And in other situations, such as when people get wealthier and get other kind of interests, then they also have other motivations which might completely overshadow the economic motivation that they started with.
Yeah, that seems perfectly reasonable. And I think we should move on to individuals in history. This is quite a brief section, but I thought it was important because it's perhaps one of Marx's more bizarre kind of tirades, where he believes that history goes its own way and according to the laws of nature. So he believes there's some kind of natural order to history, which seems very bizarre to anyone who's probably studied history, because one thing from at least my reading of history is that there seems to be very little in the way of predictability of what happens, just as a general rule.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was specifically talking about economic systems. He had his economic theory, which was his historical explanation of kind of economic political history, which was that you had kind of a primitive proto-communist society, then you had a move to feudalism, and then from feudalism you had moved to capitalism, and then then that was what was in place at his time, according to him, and then that there was a need to move to another stage, which was socialism, and then the last stage would be communism. And so that kind of historical progression was, according to him, inevitable, right?
Yeah, that's essentially his interpretation of how history would progress. And he really hated the kind of typical Western tradition of interpreting history of great individuals. And he really disliked this. And essentially, he would say, well, had Caesar never crossed the Rubicon, bringing the end to the Roman Republic, someone else would have filled that same role.
Yep.
And although I'm putting words in Marx's mouth, I'm sure he would have probably agreed with that. Like, he didn't want to emphasize that any one individual could have a significant influence on history. He believed that the factors were set in motion and there was nothing any one individual could do.
So the roles would have already been set, and the individual just fulfilled the roles and assumed those positions. Other positions would have already been there.
Yeah, but I don't necessarily agree with that at all. I think that's a terrible interpretation of history. Like, there are so many individuals in history where they had these weird individual quirks that made them the way they are and made things play out the way they did, which wouldn't have otherwise even played out in the next most similar person, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think I get what you mean, but isn't that? I would say I agree that you have people with such an individual kind of quirky nature or something like that it makes them different in a scenario where someone else would have acted differently, and that's what produced like snowball effects in the future. But isn't, when something is just, someone is just acting generically, and something is just like moving by itself, and there's no one really, no purposeful action behind it, and it's just something that someone does.
Sure.
It's the NPC position.
I can kind of use the example of someone like Stalin, where had he kind of in the latter years of his dictatorship of the USSR. Yeah. Had he not been so incredibly paranoid, perhaps far fewer number of people would have died. Like, had another communist assumed the same position in that dictatorship, they may have been secure enough in their own position that they wouldn't feel the need to kill numbers of people. And of course, you've got the case of the doctor's plot, where he killed so many doctors that none of them wanted to help him, so they left him dying on the floor.
Yeah.
So had it been someone else, perhaps it would have been different.
Yeah, I think you're right in that. I actually think if we are talking about the Soviet Union, a good example of this is Gorbachev, because he had what he did was he inherited, became the leader of the Soviet Union, and he allowed for the de facto secession of the USSR's satellite states, and therefore for the kind of whole USSR empire to fall, just because he didn't think he should repeat what he had done in Hungary in 1956, or in Czechoslovakia in 1968. And so he could have done that. There was precedent for that when countries try to separate themselves from the sphere of influence of the Soviet Union, and they're going to get the tanks in the street. So he could have done that, and that would have been predictable, but instead he chose not to do it and chose to kind of sit back and let it play out. And that's what caused the USSR to ultimately collapse in the way that it did.
Okay, I'm not very good with my post-Stalin Russian history. Like, anything from the Tsars to Stalin, I'm good with, but beyond that, I'm completely ignorant. So.
Yeah, so that's kind of a remarkable story that is well known, but no one... barely talk about it.
No, I'm not familiar
with
it.
Is that so. Like the collapse of the Soviet Union happened in a quite clean way? Like nothing. There was no widespread bloodshed. The rulers were overthrown kind of peacefully. Not everywhere, of course. Like in Romania, the family of Ceausescu was all killed. But overall. In comparison with other revolutions in the past, this was a very clean collapse of an empire like that. And so that's a story that is rarely talked about, and it's a weird...
Yeah, that's a really good case of what I was looking for, actually. Probably better than the one I gave, actually.
That's a good case of what you're talking about, because you wouldn't expect it to happen like that.
Exactly,
but it did,
yeah.
Because of that one person, because he didn't decide to do the usual thing. Mm-hmm. He decided to do something that... he wasn't expected by anyone to do.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So I want to move on to the final section now, which is Marx on the limitations to the individual. So Marx didn't necessarily deny the importance of the individual, but he saw them part of a collective which formed their worldview, essentially, just to reiterate the part from the first part. So he says, men inevitably enter into definite relations which, independent of their will, namely relations of production. So essentially what he's saying here is people are limited by the fact that they have to work to put food on the table.
Right.
That's the gist of what he's saying, which, you know, no one's going to dispute that. That's obvious. Yeah, fair enough. But he has a very interesting take on slavery and serfdom. So he recognised that the oppressor still had some obligations to the oppressed, in that they still had to ensure they were fed and cared for when they are not working, to ensure their so-called service in the future continued. So in this context, Marx viewed liberal reforms that sought to bring equality before the law as freeing the exploiter from the responsibility from their of these people's lives.
Okay, right.
Which is a very unusual take, perhaps, because particularly to free Western societies, the notion of people being free is a very inherent thing. But in Marx's time, I think it's a product of the scarcity of his time that he believed that perhaps some people were better off.
So he would make the analogy that kind of persists among Marxists to this day, that employment and kind of economic relations between an employer and an employee are similar to a relation between a slave and a slave master,
yeah,
and that it's much more visible, much more transparent if it's a slave and a slave master, and then therefore you can see that someone is the oppressor, someone is the oppressed, and mm-hmm. then you can say to the slave master, you have these like obligations that you have to fulfill. It's not just that you can do whatever you want with them, but if it's the economic relations that the liberals supposedly had been advocating for, then the same thing is kind of relinquished in the economic relations between the employee and the employer.
Essentially, the employer is absolved of their sins if they're in a liberal society, whereas in a society that Marx envisioned, they should be kind of held accountable.
Yeah. And so that in Marx's view, right, so there's the employer-employee relationship is analogous to that of the slave and the slave master. And so if you're trying to remove the responsibility of the employer, it's the same thing as if you were saying to the slave master that it's fine if he kind of beats his slave to death, something like that, right? am I understanding that correctly?
I'm not entirely sure. Like,
because he was trying to point out that the relation between the employer and the employee
the dynamic
is not free, mm-hmm. Because there are economic constraints that put the employee in a much worse position to negotiate and things like that. So mm-hmm. he would say that because of these outside constraints, the situation that you end up with is essentially similar to that of a slave and a slave master. I mean, I don't agree. I don't agree in his context, and I especially don't agree in like today's society, because it's much less relevant, that kind of a critique. But that's, I think, how mm-hmm. how he would see the situation in those kind of societal relations.
Yeah, in the modern day, like at least in a Western society, we only need to work for essentially what is half of our life, because we have perhaps 40 years at the lowest, maybe 40 to 50 is kind of the average where mm-hmm. we have to work to provide for ourselves. But in our childhood and in our old age, we are... labor is able to provide for ourselves, and so in those cases we are, even in Marx's view, free. So if we have no obligations to an employer, we are essentially disproving Marx's idea that, you know, if you are bound by either employment contract or serfdom, you are somehow forever going to be burdened, if you get what I'm trying to say.
Probably.
Anyway, I think it's best to end it there, and thank you very much for watching, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids, some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.